Welcome to the Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. Today is Monday, January 21st. It's Martin Luther King Day, and we're here to tell stories about Martin Luther King and related topics. I'm your storytelling co-host, Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasz Siolkowski, the other co-host. I guess that's what it means, yes. Co.
And we're so glad you're listening to us this morning, and we're looking forward to our show. Right. How was your weekend, Stasz?
My weekend was wonderful.
And I understand that you spent some time outdoors last night, in this frigid weather, but you had a good reason.
Last night, I went out to look at the moon and watch as the earth moved in the path between the moon and the sun.
Casting a shadow.
And first, there was a light area where it became generally less, kind of dark. That's called the penumbra. And then later, it was in the umbra. And my wife and I went out at intervals after starting at about 9:30.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And then once the actual event began, we went out about every 10 minutes. And she was more of a trooper than I was. She stayed out a couple minutes more each time than I did because I'm old and I hate the cold. I'm going to get a t-shirt with that on it.
Well, my celestial partner was out there last night taking photos from probably about the same time. Right. In fact, he might have been out there setting up the camera while it was not quite dark yet, right, if I remember correctly.
Good idea to get it equally cold. Yeah. Yesterday, I lined up my telescope and everything, but I decided that because of the position of where we are and the position of the moon when the excitement stuff started for about an hour and a half or so, was directly overhead of our house.
Yes, we had the same experience.
I didn't feel comfortable trying to line up my telescope to look straight up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was sensible because it would have been a difficult task since I have a telescope that has to be manually operated. But it was worth watching.
Yeah, it was exciting. And the stars were amazing last night. Yes. I really enjoyed that part. Yes. Maybe most, being able to see
so much. When the moon was covered.
Yes, yeah, I was only out there, really, when the moon was covered, or almost all the way covered, so that was fun.
Orion was incredibly bright,
yes,
and so was the constellation that people call the twins, and which I call something else, that was in a line with the moon, which was very nice, two very bright stars. Castor and Pollux.
I think I did see them. I wouldn't have known that that's who they were, but I remember spending some time looking at two.
My name for them are Fana and Terli.
Okay. They're right near Orion.
Well, if you take a line from the two bright stars in Orion, one from a foot and one from his shoulder, they go and take a straight line up there that'll point right to those two stars.
Oh, maybe those aren't the same two stars then. Okay, I'll have to go check it out again tonight.
Yeah, should see them.
Before we wander any further down this primrose path, I want to acknowledge that Andy Offit Irwin is responsible for that wonderful song that starts our program each time. Singer-songwriter, symphonic whistler, and storyteller extraordinaire. Andy's given us permission to use his original song to open our program, and we are grateful that he's done that.
And it's a good thing we don't have to pay him royalties for using it.
Yes, it is a good thing, she said, smothering her giggles. Okay, so what would you like to do next or first? Or?
Well, I know you have stories.
I do. I have at least two.
And I have, the only thing I would have about Martin Luther King are anecdotes.
Mm-hmm. Well, only one of my tales is about Martin Luther King. Well,
I do remember that when Martin Luther King was assassinated, I was a young school teacher, and I remember how it affected many communities. There were riots and lots of anger, and in contrast, I remember the same year, just a few months later, Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and the public reacted differently. It was a much different reaction to Kennedy's assassination. The same kind of outrage, and I think at the same level, but there wasn't the same anger. And I remember that, although I must say I was not in any way touched by any of that. It was a very difficult time. In fact, I, even though I've been alive long enough to have lived through the Second World War and Korea and Vietnam and the Gulf War and that, I think that when that happened, those two assassinations, I think in my mind and in my feelings are really a turning point politically and socially. Lots of things changed after that, even more so than after Kennedy's assassination, because Kennedy's assassination was...
You mean JFK?
I just, there was a different mood completely about that. Didn't seem to... it affected the country almost like losing a grandfather or an uncle that was beloved or something. But with Robert Kennedy, there was a lot of anger and a lot of wonder about why anybody would have killed him, especially somebody who wasn't a known terrorist or an activist or anything like that. And then with Martin Luther King a few months before that, it was just an outrageous act by a coward. And it has left an imprint, and I think that, at least in my mind and in my life, it has left an imprint on me as if that was a really big change in how many groups in this country react politically and still do today.
I think it, beginning with John Kennedy's assassination, there was, from my perception, was just this shift in what was possible and the violence that was possible in this country, and it became a pattern, you know. Yeah. After that, and I don't think we've recovered from that.
No. Yet,
still, but okay, shift gears for a moment.
Okay.
Because I kind of pushed us into storytelling quickly, and usually we start with the Speak Story series.
Right.
So I'm going to have us back up a bit.
Well, that's
and,
okay.
Are you willing to do that?
Sure.
Okay.
Speak Story series begins in March. However, we can't announce the name of who's going to be there because we don't know. And the list of people who will be performing this year at Shepherd University for the Speak Story series will be announced February 10th at a fundraiser featuring Jim May, storyteller from Illinois, who is an award-winning storyteller and an author. And Jim will be in town. He's coming in town on February 8th. And then on the 9th, he's going to be in Sharpsburg. He's staying with me and my wife. And he's going to be doing a workshop from 1 to 5 in Sharpsburg at 105 South Mechanic Street, which just happens to be the most famous house in the place because it sits next to a little store that sells ice cream. And so I tell people all the time, if you want to find my house, look for Nutter's Ice Cream Store. And there we are, right next door.
I wonder if the people who work at Nutter's ever expected that they would become famous because they're next door to Stash Sokowski.
I know. People go in there all the time and ask them, do you know where Stash lives? And they send them next door. So, and then...
A story to warm the heart.
Yes. Or to start the lying. On February 10th, Jim May will be performing at the fundraiser for Speak Story Series at the Shepherdstown Community Club at 7 o'clock in the evening. And there will also be a silent auction that night, so people can come in and spend money buying incredible relics and antiques and...
Artifacts.
That's a word I've loved ever since I first heard it. Artifacts.
It sounds so important.
I know.
Really, it just means leftovers.
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, $35 at the door, and you can get a admission to this wonderful fundraiser. There will be finger food. I always love that comment too. First time I heard it, I was a teenager, actually, and I really was boggled by that. I thought it was maybe a variety of fingers, like, and I thought about the lady fingers.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, that's good. But there will
17
be,
varieties of lady fingers.
Right.
Toddler fingers. Right.
There will be some refreshments and entertainment and an interview, a question and answer session with Adam Booth and Jim May, two outstanding storytellers. And then, let's see, I think that's it.
Okay, and Adam will be announcing
the roster. The roster, and we have a bunch of special things going on. One of the things that's coming up is there will be an opportunity for people to be involved in a Reader's Theater.
Oh.
That will be run by a pair of storytellers. Who travel together and do this, and they will be in Shepherdstown for an entire week, and they will have people can volunteer and audition to be in the Reader's Theater, and then they'll have I think two or three rehearsals with these storytelling theatrical people, and on Friday of that week there will be a performance, and so maybe some of us will have a chance.
Sounds very cool.
When Adam mentioned that part, I was the first one to raise my hand. I wanted to audition before I even knew what it was about.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to put in a plug for this radio station. This is enlightenradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, just across the river from... Well, it's not even across the... It's across the creek from Shepherdstown, across the river from Hagerstown.
I have no idea.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of water. We're in a watery area, so you can pretty much guarantee you'll have to cross some bridges to get anywhere. Right. And I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stash Siolkowski.
And we're your storytelling hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour every Monday at 12 noon. And I think last week we forgot to remind our listeners about our podcasts, that we have all of the programs for the past maybe 2.5 years up at Enlighten.
Talltales.enlightenradio.org.
Whoops. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Got that backwards. That felt like math for a minute, Stosh. I had my dots in the wrong place.
Yes.
Okay. And today is Martin Luther King Day, Monday, January 21st, 2019. And so we're going to be telling some stories related to mid-century and connected events. How about if I tell an MLK story?
I think you should.
Okay. That's what I'm going to do then, if you think I should.
Of course. Thank you.
Okay. Well, this is a story I've told a couple times before, and it came out of my desire to put my own experience in a frame with Martin Luther King, not in any way equitable frame, but just talk about my experience and how Martin Luther King made a difference in my life. So many of our listeners will know this, but since we're on the radio and you may not have met me personally or heard me talk before, but I am a mixed race person. My mom was from a Jewish family in Brooklyn, New York. Her great grandparents came here from England, Poland, and Austria. My dad was a light-skinned African American. I don't have a lot of information about the individual regions that his ancestors came from in Africa. He also had a considerable amount of European and Native American blood as well. But my dad's great-grandfather was enslaved in Virginia and then in Maryland, and so he didn't have a lot of information about his parents. But my parents were community and political activists long before I was born. And yet, Martin Luther King changed my parents' vision of America. And here's a quote that I usually insert at this point. "The hope of a secure and livable world lies with disciplined nonconformists who are dedicated to justice, peace, and brotherhood." That's from Martin Luther King Jr. himself. So, growing up in this family of political activists, I understood at a pretty early age that my mom and dad believed in the need for social change. Martin Luther King's non-violent resistance movement provided a vehicle for getting from where we were in the 1950s to a more open society. He proved that nonviolent resistance can work here in the United States, not just in books, not just for Jesus, not just in Gandhi's India. But Martin Luther King Jr. and his philosophy did not spring fully formed out of the mist. That's an interesting ring or alarm you have there.
My motorcycle.
Your motorcycle, okay. But it's turned. Your motorcycle is at rest now, I trust. So this story is partly about where Martin Luther King came from and an attempt to put him in context that I was not aware of as a child, but that I have researched and come to understand better as an adult. So Martin and the other King children always called their mother, Mother Dear. This was a formal and very structured household there is a King family story about Martin's closest playmates outside the family, two little white boys whose family owned the general store across the street from the King home on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. Now, one day, Martin crossed the street to ask his friends to come over to his family's backyard to play. And this was a common occurrence. They often played together in each other's homes and backyards. But the boy's mother met him at the door and told Martin that they could no longer play together because Martin and his family were Negroes. That was her explanation to him. The King family didn't go to segregated movie theaters, seldom rode segregated streetcars, never patronized segregated restaurants. And sheltered within his family circle, that was one of Martin Luther King's earliest experiences of exclusion and racism. Martin asked, "Mother dear, why do white people treat us so mean?" Alberta Williams King gathered her three children close and explained the reality of segregation in schools, in public buildings, stores, drinking fountains, and elevators. But she ended her explanation with words of hope. "You must never come to think that this exclusion is a reflection of who you are. You are the equal of any other child. Someday, someday, it will be better." And young Martin looked at his mother and said, "Mother dear, someday I am going to turn this world upside down." When Martin Luther King graduated from high school and started his studies, like his father and grandfather before him, at Morehouse College, an elite, still well-respected, historically black school in Atlanta, he was considering careers in medicine and law. The only thing he was quite sure of was that he did not want to be a minister like his father and grandfather before him. At Morehouse, he made two discoveries that helped set the course of his adult life. First, he began reading philosophers and liberal theologians such as Reinhold Niebuhr, a theological pacifist who saw connections between politics and faith. You may know him as author of the Serenity Prayer. "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference," Reinhold Niebuhr. Henry David Thoreau was another author that Martin discovered at this point in his life, the abolitionist and anti-imperialist who wrote about the right of conscience in resisting unfair laws. Paul Tillich was another who preached the importance of religious freedom for humanity's spiritual development, among many others that Martin discovered in college. Second, new experiences with racism and the responses of his Morehouse colleagues brought Martin new insights. Between college semesters, he was working as a stevedore and a field worker on tobacco farms, working beside less privileged black men and hearing the racial slurs daily of whites that they worked with. At Morehouse, King spent hours in conversation with educated men who were fascinated by the psychology of racism. He began to study the benefits to those in power when poor people are polarized by race and religion, and not just in the United States, all over the world. And these experiences with religious exploration and the everyday world of racial oppression helped King to recognize Christian ministry as a strategy, as a venue for social change. His last year at Morehouse, Martin's first sermon at Ebenezer Baptist Church received a thunderous ovation from his community and led to ordination in the tradition of the National Baptist Convention. With his Morehouse degree, a seminary degree, a doctorate from Boston University, and then a new bride in 1953, he was hired at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. Less than 2 years later, on December 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks sat down on a bus and refused to stand up for a white man. And that was the incident that catapulted Martin Luther King onto the national stage as coordinator of the Montgomery bus boycott and sparked his life's work as an organizer and public spokesperson for the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King was 26 years old. Now, one more piece of information. You remember Mother Dear in this story, Alberta Williams King. In 1974, 6 years after Martin was murdered in Memphis, Tennessee, she was playing the organ for an Ebenezer church service. A black man from Ohio who was hostile to Christianity and very antagonistic to Christians brought a firearm into the church. He was looking for Martin Luther King Sr., but Martin's father wasn't there. So the man turned his gun on Mother Dear instead and killed her. That man was tried and sentenced to death. His sentence was then commuted to life imprisonment because of the King family's outspoken commitment to nonviolence and their opposition to the execution. I'll close with another quote from Martin Luther King. Mankind must evolve for all human conflict, a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love.
Wow. That's very good.
It's taken me a while to get there, yes. But thank you.
So I have to admit ignorance in this, in one instance here. Martin Luther King's mother was killed in the church, and was she the only person?
I think she was the only person killed that day.
Wow. I absolutely did not know that.
The family was targeted, and she was the most visible member of the family for that.
I can't imagine why I don't know that.
I remember when it happened. I did not remember the commutation of the execution sentence. But it is, just to know that is incredibly powerful to me. I remember being very distressed and shocked when she was murdered, but I didn't follow up on the story at the time, or there were so many other things going on as part of that story that I didn't remember the family's opposition to the execution. But knowing that, it just makes clear that Martin Luther King's legacy and his family's engagement in his work goes on. I mean, even today, you can still read about the King family and their work.
Right. And I don't know what to call this, either an excuse or just plain ignorance, but I know in the 70s, early 70s especially, I was a chemistry teacher at a public school starting in 1970, and for quite a number of years after that, I probably did not pick up a newspaper or watch news on the TV or listen to it on the radio because I immersed myself in my teaching and coaching. And that certainly is not an excuse for not knowing things. But I really did live in my own mind and in my own behavior in the teaching and coaching. And a number of times in recent years, I've been amazed to find out things that I should have known, and it was because I had stopped paying attention to anything else in the world. There are many things that happened that people have looked at me and said, "How could you not know that?" And I at first used to make a joke of it and say, "Well, I was a track coach." And
that always, great excuse, Sasha.
I'm glad you laughed because most people would just look at me as if I had lost my mind and started giving them directions to the grocery store when they wanted to know where the mall was or something. You know, so it is interesting. I do have a personal story about Martin Luther King Day, because I don't remember when it became officially a national holiday, but I do remember a number of times how people I knew said they would never celebrate it, and lots of discussion about it. There was, I don't know what year it became a holiday, but it wasn't a holiday yet, and I was coaching track, and I heard a rumor that the black students, black athletes on my track team were, along with a number of black students in the school where I was teaching, were planning on skipping school that day. And I had a meeting before every track practice, and a couple of days before Martin Luther King's birthday, I excused all the white students from the room and said, I want to have a meeting with the African-American athletes. They didn't know what I was going to talk about, so they said, well, one of the leaders on my team, a co-captain, actually said, let them stay. I don't care what they hear. Because he figured I was going to talk about something about Martin Luther King. And I suggested to them, and I didn't. I told everybody to stay in the room. And I suggested to them that taking that day off and skipping school, and therefore also skipping track practice, was not something that Dr. King would have approved of. Because they had no plans. They weren't going to go and protest something or make a statement or go to church or anything like that. They just were going to take the day off. And we had a really good discussion about what I thought Dr. King would suggest to them. And I was told by a number of students that I had no idea what Dr. King would say, because I couldn't understand the problems that he had. And I agreed with them. I couldn't say for sure, but I said I had learned enough about his life and about his way of dealing with things that walking away from something that responsibilities was not the way to solve a problem or to make a statement. And to their credit, and some wrongly placed credit on me, the students, none of them, the students on my track team or students from my classes, because I mentioned it also in my chemistry classes, much to the chagrin of the administration of the school, but none of those students took that day off. And I was really proud of that, because I thought, for once in my life, I had said something that made sense to students, and they actually listened. So that was a good experience I had with that.
Yeah.
And I really think because of that, I had a much better relationship with students on my track team after that, because they thought that some of the things I talked about and thought were really important, even though they weren't about Martin Luther King, and afterwards, they thought I had some sense.
Little did they know.
That's right. Little did they know.
Well, that's a really interesting story to me, because I struggle every year with what to do on Martin Luther King Day, how to honor his memory, and how to spend my time in a way that acknowledges the debt that this country owes him, and the sense that that I have, both from my parents and from Martin Luther King, that we should, the idea is to make progress, it's to move forward. So if I am only, if I'm using this day as a holiday, whatever rest and relaxation I'm taking should be spent in at least contemplation of the meaning of his sacrifice, the meaning of his life work. And that's not always easy to do because there's lots of other pressures. You know, we all have obligations, and I am perennially behind on all of mine. So the idea of carving out time for contemplation is difficult any day, and it's not any easier on this day, but I do try to make an effort. And even something like music, taking time to celebrate the music that King would have listened to or would have used in his work. That's an easy way for me to get my mind in the right place and think about and think the thoughts that help me get to a better place. So I'm grateful to be, to have this pulpit, to have this radio station and this radio program that forces me to think about the importance of the day and the idea that I might have used this hour radio show today, Monday, the 21st of January, 2019, in some other way. There were lots of other stories competing for my attention and probably yours as well. And we could have done a lot of things with this day, but I'm glad we chose to focus at least part of our hour on Martin Luther King and our own experiences.
And there's this is something that I have all through my career after that episode I mentioned. Mm-hmm. I try to remind myself and people close to me that what they should do is every day they should practice what Martin Luther King taught and what he did.
Yes.
That, you know, it's not only, it's kind of like birthdays. Don't only be nice to your sister on her birthday. Be nice to your sister every day, or your brother, or your neighbor, or, and I find that that's better in my mind. That's not a criticism of you, because I know you, and I know you do practice those things.
Well, I don't every day. It's a good reminder for everyone.
Well, I've
certainly,
you haven't called me a hunky once in the 2 years we've 4 years we've known each other. Did the station go off the air?
Dead silence.
I know.
No, I can't remember ever calling anybody a honky. There's lots of other of other words that can substitute.
Right.
Blah 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 blah. Okay, so
stories in the round should hear something from us.
Okay, stories in the round. I do have some tellers lined up for season 6 of Stories in the Round, and I'm in the process of gathering agreements, contracts with our tellers. But I only have two date. I can, well, I'll tell you two tellers that I know for certain are coming. Andy Offit Irwin in. Well, I'm not even going to give the dates because I worry that people will get moved around. But Andy Offit Irwin will be here during the summer. And Janice Curtis Green, who's a member of the National Association of Black Storytellers. She's the current president of the National Association of Black Storytellers and an active member of the Griot Circle of Maryland. She lives in Baltimore and is one of the leaders of the local organization as well as the national organization. And she has confirmed with me that she is coming. So I'm moving along, but slowly, and as soon as I have more. But if people want details about a particular month or they've heard rumors about a particular teller, you can reach me at 301-730-1638, or you can email me at fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com.
And couldn't people also contact you and make a suggestion about a storyteller that they may have heard?
They certainly may. Yeah. I do have more than enough people on the roster for this coming season, but I'm always interested to hear what our listeners want to hear and suggestions. And you never know, your suggestion may already be on our tentative roster, and I can thrill you by telling you that if you get in touch. And suggestions are always well appreciated. It is time, I think, for me to say again that you're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. And I am thinking about another story, but Stosh, do you have a story you would like to share?
I honestly do not have a story
ready to go.
Well, no.
Okay,
I only have anecdotes in my brain.
Anecdotes are good. Well, let me tell this one, and this may spark some synapses for you, and who knows? Okay, so this is a story about another historical African American figure who has been important to me as I think about not just marginalized or minority groups in the United States, but the power of individuals to make a difference. So this story is about an African American, a Dutch-speaking New York abolitionist named Isabella Baumfree. Now, you may know her, you probably know her as Sojourner Truth. She was born Isabella Baumfree, enslaved about 1797, to enslaved parents. Her mother was kidnapped and brought to the United States from Guinea on the west coast of Africa, her father from Ghana, just south of Guinea. Her parents were bought and enslaved by a Dutch-American farmer in New York State, just 100 miles north of New York City in the 1700s. Now, I knew Sojourner's Truth's work from my parents' stories about her later life, but the story that I recently unearthed, I'm sure other people may have known it, but I didn't, is about how Isabella Baumfree became that great orator and abolitionist in her later life. Until she was sold from that Dutch-American farm in New York State at the age of nine, Isabella spoke only Dutch. English was her second language. On the death of her first owner, she was sold off the farm, part of a package purchase, with a flock of sheep. And such were the customs of slave sales, to commonly sell children and livestock as a set or a purchase lot. She was the keeper of the sheep, and so it made sense to the men buying and selling that she would go with the sheep. Now, her new slave master was a much more vicious and cruel man who beat her daily, at least partly because she did not speak English and therefore did not understand his instructions. She was sold twice more after that, eventually to a farmer who treated her fairly well, although his wife was abusive to her. At age 18, probably about 1815, Isabella fell in love with a slave named Robert from a nearby farm. But Robert's owner forbade the match on economic grounds because the children of Robert and Isabella would belong to Isabella's owner, thus robbing Robert's enslaver of future slaves he might have if Robert married an enslaved woman on his farm. Robert and Isabella continued their relationship anyway. Isabella became pregnant. And when Robert was discovered as the father, he was savagely beaten by his owner and died of his injuries. Isabella was then forced to marry an older slave belonging to her owner and eventually had 5 children, the first by Robert and 4 by the second husband, Thomas. Emancipation of slaves by the state of New York began just before 1800, 1799, but it was a gradual process not completed for more than 25 years. Isabella's owner promised that he would free her 1 year before state emancipation, but he reneged on that promise. You remember she was originally sold with a flock of sheep. She was still engaged with sheep on this farm, carding wool, spinning and knitting. And as final obligation to the man who enslaved her, as she reported in her later written autobiography, she angrily finished spinning 100 pounds of wool late in 1826, more than 25 years after emancipation began in the state of New York. She says, "I did not run off, for I thought that wicked, but walked off, believing that to be right." She took with her her youngest child, the infant Sophia, but she was forced to leave the other children behind. Under the New York State Emancipation Act, enslaved children were bound as servants till they were into their 20s. And of her 5 children, one died as a baby, but there is documentation that she was able to stay in contact with the rest through her lifetime. Isabella found refuge for herself and her infant, Sophia, in 1826 with a couple named Van Wagenen, who agreed to buy her services from her former owner for the remainder of that year that she walked away from the farm, until the state's emancipation took effect for her. And during that time, she learned that her 5-year-old son, Peter, had been sold illegally, specifically because he was to be emancipated, to a new owner in Alabama. With help from the Van Wagenens, she sued the New York slave owner in court, and after months of legal proceedings, her son was returned to her, though not before he had been beaten and abused in Alabama. Isabella Bounfrey won one of the very first cases brought by a black woman against a white man in the United States courts. And I think it's pretty obvious that that experience of success with United States law would have influenced her as she became the person we now know as Sojourner Truth. In 1829, she moved with her children to New York City, where she found work as a housekeeper. 10 years later, her son Peter took a job on a whaling ship and disappeared under mysterious circumstances, was never heard from again. By 1843, Isabella Bounfrey had changed her name to Sojourner Truth, become a Seventh-day Adventist preacher and an abolitionist. The dictionary definition of sojourner is a temporary resident or occupant, but the biblical definition, and surely one that Isabella was familiar with, is foreigner or stranger, guest, either wanted or unwanted. The Old Testament and the Torah insist on the sacred duty of a host to his guests, even to suffering great hardship, to ensure the protection of those to whom you owe hospitality. Isabella, now called Sojourner Truth, joined an abolitionist communal farm called the Northampton, Massachusetts Association of Education and Industry, which also supported women's rights, religious tolerance, and pacifism. 210 members lived on 500 acres with a livestock farm, a sawmill, a gristmill, and a silk factory. There, Sojourner Truth met William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist editor of the Liberator newspaper, advocate for women's rights. David Ruggles, who was a freeborn black abolitionist and a printer, as well as Frederick Douglass and other important reformers. In 1850, William Lloyd Garrison published Sojourner Truth's autobiography, The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, a Northern Slave. In 1851, Sojourner delivered her famous extemporaneous speech on women's rights, later known as the Ain't I a Woman speech, to the Ohio Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio. Over the next 10 years, Truth spoke before hundreds of audiences from New York City to Ohio to Michigan, where she eventually settled. In Michigan, in 1858, someone in the crowd interrupted her to accuse her of being a man, and she immediately, spontaneously pulled open her blouse to reveal her breasts. I have to think this is a woman who's very clear why she's up there on the lectern. She said, I feel safe in the midst of my enemies, for the truth is powerful and it prevails. Using the speaking fees that she earned from her circuit speaking, Sojourner bought a house in Battle Creek, Michigan, and settled there with her daughter Sophia and two grandsons. During the Civil War, she helped recruit black troops for the Union Army. Her grandson, James Caldwell, enlisted with the 54th Massachusetts, the black regiment led by Robert Gould Shaw, and celebrated in that film Glory for their courageous fatal assault on Fort Wagner in South Carolina. Sojourner worked with the National Freedmen's Relief Association in Washington to improve conditions for African Americans. She met with President Abraham Lincoln. And while working at the Freedmen's Hospital in Washington, she rode on the city streetcars to help force desegregation of that transportation method. In the late 1860s and 70s, following passage of the 13th Amendment that freed all U.S. slaves, she embarked on another speaking circuit talking about the rights of women. She was one of those women suffragists who argued long and hard that those civil rights amendments, the 13th Amendment, the 14th, 15th, 16th Amendment should apply to women as well. She argued that now was the best time for equal rights, such as suffrage, to keep things going on, fearing that once the fight for black suffrage settled down, it would take a long time to warm people back up to rights for women. She said, I'm glad to see that men are getting their rights, but I want women to get theirs too, and while the water is stirring, I will step into the pool. She pursued land grants from the government of Ulysses S. Grant for 7 years, telling audiences that those in poverty must have land to work, not handouts or stipends from other taxpayers. Throughout her life, she spoke the truth as she saw it, never stepping away from controversy and always for the rights of freed slaves, women's suffrage, prison reform, and against capital punishment. In addition to Frederick Douglass, Garrison, and Ruggles, she had many loyal friends and supporters among veteran social reformers, radicals, Quakers, Methodists, Hicksite Quakers, Amy and Isaac Post, suffragist and abolitionist Frances Gage, who wrote books for children and adults under the pseudonym Aunt Fanny, suffragists Lucretia Mott and Susan B. Anthony, and Ellen G. White, co-founder of the Seventh-day Adventist movement. Sojourner Truth died at home in Battle Creek, Michigan, November 1883. She was 85 years old, and 40 years into her life's purpose with that charismatic born-again name. More than 3,000 people crowded into the Battle Creek Tabernacle to pay their last respects to the little girl born enslaved who awed, badgered, and benefited millions of Americans. Her last words in print, I am not going to die. I'm going home like a shooting star.
Wow.
I love that story.
That is wonderful. And I took some notes.
Uh-oh.
But just for myself.
Okay.
About amendments. I think I should learn what each of the amendments are.
I think maybe we'll have a whole program on those.
Okay, amendments. You can quiz me.
Well, you can quiz me too. I hope I got my numbers right when I was spouting out those numbers.
Well, that makes sense. 13, 14, 15, 16.
Okay.
But I don't even know how many amendments there are. I think 27.
Something. Yeah, something around there.
Maybe 27th, 26th, 27th.
We could do a whole program on constitutional process, and there are some wild stories.
Oh, yeah.
From our history.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
And probably wild stories coming up in 2019 right. on constitutional process. Okay.
Yes. I hear lots of stuff in the news. There was an interesting thing in the paper and on the internet this weekend, a confrontation between a Native American man and a young man. And I read a lot about that this morning.
Did you? Yeah, yes. I heard this hearsay. I didn't read the article, but
it turns out that the young man claims he did not mean disrespect, and it seems that would be true because of what I read that happened. The Native American man actually borrowed a drum and moved between a group of black people who were black youth who were associated with Israel in some way, and who were chanting things at a group of white teenagers. Mm-hmm. And the man, I think his name was Phillips, picked this drum up, borrowed it from somebody, and began doing a Native American prayer and moved between them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually was the person who moved toward the students. They didn't move towards him. And so it seems like typical of our news reporting, they have this great picture, and it looks like this white American boy is
taunting
the Native American, and the Native American man actually said, "No, I was the one who moved towards them." In hope that we could have a peaceful diffuse the situation. So I thought that was really good that at least one reporter got it right. And that unfortunately, those kind of things almost never calm down the bigots and racists and on both sides of situations, because that one picture was definitely an awful picture.
Mm-hmm.
The young man looked like he was taunting the Native American elder. But
well, we'll have to pursue that one too. And all of these are wonderful stories for the future. Close us out, Stosh.
Okay. This is Stosh Ziolkowski
and Fanny Crawford,
your co-host for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. Independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia. Closing out this week's show, the Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, which certainly fits us, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for
Philip Marlowe.
Whoa,
okay. Mystery. Suspense.